From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Duking it out over affirmative action, David Duke comes to California for a heated debate.
What I'm saying, Tyrone, is just as your rights, I think, are important, and I value your rights, I say a young white boy who's 12 years old has got to have those same rights. That human rights are not just for minorities, that they're supposed to be for everyone. And that whites are entitled to human rights, and we're entitled to our constitutional rights. And that's why I'm here today, to defend those rights of the American people.
And the CIA-Contra drug connection. This isn't the first time charges have surfaced. We'll go back a decade and fill in some of the blanks. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate sustained President Clinton's veto of a bill that would have banned a form of late-term abortion. But opponents of abortion vowed to keep the issue alive during the election campaign. After a vivid floor debate about the procedure, the Senate voted 57-41, falling short of the two-thirds majority needed to override. Last week, the House narrowly voted to override the veto. The House Ethics Committee raised four new charges against Speaker Newt Gingrich yesterday, including the potentially devastating question of whether he has provided its investigation with accurate, reliable, and complete information. The committee of five Republicans and five Democrats voted unanimously to announce the expansion of its inquiry to add the issues. No details were released about those questions, which also included two new tax law issues and the question of whether he improperly used staff and facilities of a private foundation. One immediate effect of the additional charges, however, is to make it certain that the Gingrich case will not be settled before Election Day. And Vice President Al Gore says President Clinton's signing of a logging law that waives wildlife protections was the biggest mistake of the administration's 4 years. Gore singled out the law in a TV interview with David Frost. He noted, "Luckily, that law will run out on December 31st of this year." And Republican vice presidential nominee Jack Kemp says a Dole administration would never require teachers to turn over suspected illegal immigrants to the Border Patrol, as he said was called for under California's original Proposition 187. Kemp also was interviewed by Frost for a broadcast on public television. And Reform Party vice presidential nominee Pat Choate criticized presidential debate organizers for shutting him and Ross Perot out. Appearing on the same broadcast as Gore and Kemp, the Reform Party vice presidential candidate complained that the TV networks were refusing to give the Perot ticket sufficient ad time. Wannabe white and coconut were inappropriate words to describe a Mexican-American Republican congressmember. This according to a Democratic Senate candidate. Victor Morales, who is also Mexican-American, on Thursday backed away from the comments he made Wednesday about Congressman Henry Bonilla, a Republican of Texas. He said, "While I disagree strongly with the perspective Bonilla brings to his office and the manner in which he represents his constituents, public discourse should be conducted on a higher plane." Morales plans campaign appearances today with President Clinton. He said, "I used terms I should not have used." Morales is running against Republican Senator Phil Graham in the November 5th election. When asked to comment about Bonilla on Wednesday, Morales said the congressman reminded him, quote, "of the people when I was growing up that we called chocolate chips, coconuts," adding that they were dark-skinned but ignored their heritage. Bonilla has declined to respond. First elected in 1992, he's the only Republican Mexican-American in Congress. Haley Barbour, chair of the Republican National Committee, called Morales' comments abhorrent and criticized Clinton for campaigning with him. A White House spokesperson said the president had no intention of canceling his appearance with Morales, a Mesquite school teacher and political novice who ran a shoestring primary campaign from his white pickup truck. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
Cops and the Klan go hand in hand! Fight the
Cops and the Klan go hand in hand, just one of the chants when the debate over affirmative action in California reached a crescendo Wednesday night when the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, visited the campus of California State University at Northridge to debate activist Joe Hicks on the issue. Student and community protesters who tried to block Duke's appearance clashed with riot police in the most dramatic confrontation yet over Proposition 209, the initiative on the California ballot this November that would ban state and local affirmative action programs.
We've got to hold a march through this campus and reclaim it and make sure that today is a day that's remembered when students and anti-racists fought back against the Klan and in defense of affirmative action.
That's just one of the protesters outside. We're now going to bring you just a small excerpt of the debate that was going on inside. Joe Hicks is head of the Los Angeles Multicultural Collaborative. He argued for affirmative action. David Duke, former head of the Ku Klux Klan, argued against it. This was the question-answer period where people wrote down their questions and they were read to Duke and Hicks.
I have another question for you, Mr. Duke.
Yes.
My name is Tyrone Washington. I'm a 12-year-old black boy. Why do you feel that affirmative action is not needed for minorities?
Tyrone, and I don't know where you are, but here's what I think. Affirmative action. Nice to see you, Tyrone. Because, Tyrone, you want to be treated fairly in your life. If you work hard and you study hard and you do well and you score high, you want to go as far as your merit allows. You want to go far as your ability allows. Anyway, you just hold that a second. And what I'm saying, Tyrone, is just as your rights, I think, are important, and I value your rights, I say a young white boy that's 12 years old has got to have those same rights. That human rights are not just for minorities, that they're supposed to be for everyone. And that whites are entitled to human rights, and we're entitled to our constitutional rights. And that's why I'm here today, to defend those rights of the American people.
A question for both of you. If affirmative action would remain in the USA for the next 20 years, how would it help or hurt this nation? Mr. Hicks?
Well, I think, you know, and I hope that we will, in fact, through all of our efforts, maintain affirmative action not only here in the state of California, but throughout the nation. And I think if we maintain it, constantly monitor it, to make sure that it does the kinds of things that it is designed to do, always prepared to amend it, change it to meet changing conditions, I think that this nation will be a better place. Why would it not be a better place if you have in place guarantees that women and minorities, the populations that face discrimination, and I think we should also look, as Mr. Duke has pointed out, how we should in fact put into place protections for poor working white families to ensure that they also have a square shot, because we don't want to ignore the fact that there are a lot of families, working class white families, struggling. He will tell you about one part of the equation. What he won't then talk about is the fact, and he keeps saying race is not a factor. And Tyrone, what the problem here is that what he didn't say to you is that we want to make sure that race will not be the kind of factor in your life that has been for all too many in this country. That race, the call for a colorblind, neutral approach to society's problems is not the kind of answer that you need to hear. You need to hear people say to you plainly that race, unfortunately, is still a factor in this society, despite all the struggles by all the people that come before us to make that not be so. It unfortunately is so, and we have to take into account that factor, because race and gender, something that he will rarely talk about, because he always talks about the racial equation, he hasn't talked about women once. He hasn't talked about discrimination against women, because that complicates the picture. If you throw white women into that picture, then he can't just deal with the race issue. But we want to make sure people deal not only with race, but the gender factor in terms of women continually also being on the receiving end of discrimination in this country and at the receiving end of all kind of backwards notions about who women are and where they should be in our society.
I don't think women want to be given preferential treatment in a job or a promotion or a scholarship. I think women simply want to be hired or promoted or advanced or given a scholarship or whatever else on the basis of their individual merit.
Former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, and Joe Hicks, head of the Los Angeles Multicultural Collaborative, debating at California State University at Northridge, debating, of course, the issue of affirmative action. We'll be bringing you more of that debate on Monday on Democracy Now! Before conservatives succeeded in putting the so-called California Civil Rights Initiative, Proposition 209, on this November's ballot, another anti-affirmative action measure was passed by the California Board of Regents. The Regents are the group that sets policy for the state's nine-campus, 150,000-student university system. All the Regents have been appointed by Governor Pete Wilson and his Republican predecessor, George Dukmejian. Faculty and student response to the banning of affirmative action criteria in admissions has been overwhelmingly negative. In order to study the affirmative action situation more closely, two professors at the University of California at Berkeley have brought out a special issue of the critical studies journal Representation. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky spoke this week with political science professor Michael Rogan and law professor Robert Post.
Robert Post and Michael Rogan, affirmative action is a headline story now in California because of CCRI, the so-called California Civil Rights Initiative. Was this the impetus for your doing this special issue of your Journal of Cultural Theory, or did you have it in the pipeline long before this became an electoral issue?
Well, the actual impetus was SP1, which was the resolution of the Regents of the University of California, which prohibited affirmative action in hiring and in admissions at the University of California. And Representations, the journal, comes out of Berkeley, and we felt a responsibility to respond to what we viewed as rather provocative action on the part of the Regents. And so almost all of the contributors to this issue come from the University of California at Berkeley.
Why don't you explain for a minute, Robert Post, as a law professor, as briefly as you can as a law professor, what the anti-affirmative action resolution by the Board of Regents that you're referring to is trying to do?
Well, they passed two resolutions. And as you remember, this was when the governor, Pete Wilson, was running for president. And I think one of his platform issues was to oppose affirmative action the way he had opposed illegal immigration several years before in Prop 187. And at his instigation and with the cooperation of Ward Connolly, one of the members of the Board of Regents, there was a push on the part of the Board of Regents to end affirmative action at the University of California, Berkeley. And this was done through the enactment of two resolutions. The first resolution prohibited us from using race or gender as a factor in admissions, and the second resolution prohibited us from using it as a factor in hiring.
Michael Rogan, you've been at Cal since 1963. You've seen a number of these tempests come and go. Some of them proved to be transitory. This one would seem to be a little more far-reaching and would have more of a sense of permanence to it if implemented, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the state is becoming more and more minority, and the effort of this intervention by the Regents is in the name of colorblindness to actually racialize California politics and the university as well by creating an issue which is, going to make people anxious and blame minorities for troubles that happen in the state. And so actually probably in terms of its effect on the university, the loyalty oath is what you have to go back to, because although in the 60s there were also regential interventions with governance, a lot of them actually, but the this effort to sort of interfere with the way in which the University of California governs itself is really the precedent for it, really, I think, is the loyalty oath.
Now, why don't both of you as functioning professors there talk a little bit about what the reaction on campus has been, because people listening to this nationwide maybe hearing about similar things in their own states, and certainly possibly if they're interested in it, have heard about California. How has the University of California as a faculty body and as a student body responded to the Regents efforts to abolish affirmative action?
Well, I think the faculty, although there's, the faculty senate has actually passed a resolution of censure against the Regents for its interference with the governance of the university, which contains in it a support for affirmative action as well, although I don't think that I think the main impetus for that resolution was the sense of political intervention. That was the reason for it. But still, there's a fairly, I think, at least among people who go to Senate meetings under a crisis, widespread support for affirmative action. Students, there's been a lot of there've been meetings and demonstrations. I think among white students at the University of California, white students in the University of California are not up in arms to defend affirmative action, I would say. The opinion is kind of divided. But there have been – it's been a fairly active campus last year, not so much this year, I would say.
I would say two things about that. One is that there's sort of opposition to affirmative action nationwide, but it tends to be elite. So there's some judicial decisions, for example, in Texas, which have actually banned constitutionally affirmative action in state institutions, the Hopwood decision in Texas, for example. But there have been a number of laws introduced in various states and in the Congress prohibiting affirmative action, but they haven't gone anywhere. And I think a lot will depend nationwide on what happens this election in California. If the CCRI, if the California Civil Rights Initiative, which will, as you say, prohibit affirmative action, passes, I predict you'll see much greater political movement toward banning it in other states and on the federal level. So there's a lot at stake here in California for the rest of the country.
I might just say on that that it's the 187, the anti-so-called illegal alien initiative, got tremendous support, and Wilson used it to get himself reelected when he was an unpopular governor. And I think the feeling was that affirmative action would be the same kind of issue. And it doesn't have the same energy at the grassroots for whatever reasons than the so-called illegal alien one did, possibly because it's a presidential election and because Clinton has really distanced himself, although he isn't opposed to affirmative action. He hasn't certainly come out militantly in favor of it. So maybe because of the presidential election, or maybe for other – maybe because women are more nervous about ending affirmative action. It hasn't proved to be this sort of popular ground, racialized groundswell of 187.
And yet, as we sit here in late September and Bob Dole is getting more and more desperate, the ex-presidential candidate and governor of the state, Pete Wilson, has been urging Bob Dole to use CCRI as a campaign issue, saying this is the kind of wedge issue that he, Pete Wilson, wins on repeatedly, i.e. beating up on people he perceives to be electorally helpless.
Right. Well, it's interesting because the polls show rather strong support for CCRI, but it doesn't have, what you're saying, probably legs. It doesn't bring people out, as Michael's saying, and yet, you know, if people are asked, in general, they tend to support the anti-affirmative action stance.
I wanted to ask both of you to talk a little bit, if you would, about something that you write in here, Robert Post, about the legal framework for these anti-affirmative action mechanisms dating back to the Bakke decision in the mid-1970s, where you say Justice Lewis Powell walked a very fine line trying to define what was permissible constitutionally in establishing a diverse student body, whereas not at the same time giving special privileges to a constituency. What's happened to that fine line?
Well, it's very interesting. In the early days of affirmative action, say in the late 60s and 70s, the courts did not know what to do with it because on the one hand, they were quite aware, as Michael writes in his article in this issue, of the reality of group oppression, racialized oppression in the United States, and the need to remedy it seemed to mean to remedy it with respect to the group that was oppressed, African Americans and other ethnic groups. And so even though the courts had trouble rationalizing affirmative action, they were unwilling to strike it down. And so in the early days, they were rather accommodating. And the first and only decision at the Supreme Court level about affirmative action in a university is Bakke. And in that decision, Powell strikes a very, as you say, a very fine line between, on the one hand, permitting affirmative action, which is why we have it today, and on the other hand, trying to ideologically destabilize it and force it into a framework of individual rights. And as the opposition to affirmative action has grown, in part, I suspect, because of a slowdown in the economy and the difficulty in finding work for more and more groups, there has been an effort to make it clearer and to strike and to lose that balance, to just end affirmative action. So the Supreme Court in the workplace situation, that's to say for federal employment opportunities or state employment opportunities, has said, strictly speaking, affirmative action is out unless it can be justified as narrowly tailored to serve a compelling interest, which is a very tough standard to meet legally.
But is there a compelling interest, and how can it be proven to be a compelling interest to represent accurately and adequately the nature of who's here in California in California's educational institutions.
The court has definitively ruled, even in Bakke, that that's not a compelling interest. See, what Powell said is—
So there's no compelling interest for us to have a racially diverse, integrated, whatever word you want, representative
right.
university.
Right. In fact, that's
legally.
viewed as a constitutional aberration because it would require the notion that one's citizenship comes via one's group membership. So the court has consistently held that that can't be the reason. The reason that Powell put on the table is you have a better education if you have a more diverse education. And so he had this notion of educational diversity, which is in fact where it stems from, is Powell's opinion. And that was picked up in all the affirmative action plans. But the notion that education should be somehow representative of the racial makeup of a state or that the workforce should be representative of a state has been consistently, on the constitutional level, disavowed.
And the other thing that's been disavowed is the notion that affirmative action is a legitimate redress for a history of racial inequality. You can't look at which is, absolutely bizarre. You cannot look at the history of the country and see racialized oppression, see slavery, see Indian dispossession, see the sort of labor repressive systems for the Mexican Americans in the Southwest. You can't look at that as a relevant factor legally when you of course, historically and politically, that is what you have to look at, but legally you can't.
So what you do look at is the particular history of discrimination. So you have to show that this institution, University of California, discriminated. And then you can use affirmative action to redress that. So it's a very narrow window with the exception of this Powell notion of diversity. Now what happened is in Bakke, Powell wrote for himself alone. It was the fifth vote. And recently, a circuit court of appeals, which is lower than the Supreme Court, overruled Bakke for the area of Texas and Louisiana. It said, well, we don't think Bakke's any more good law. So for certain parts of the country, even Bakke is no longer good law.
University of California, Berkeley professors Michael Rogan and Robert Post, they were speaking with Pacifica's national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky about affirmative action. We'll continue the debate in a moment. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We now go back to that discussion on affirmative action with University of California Berkeley professors Michael Rogan and Robert Post. They've brought out a special issue of the critical studies journal Representation on affirmative action. They're speaking with Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky.
One of the key elements here in California that we talk about over and over again on Pacifica is the rise of what I call the voting class of people, which is very different than mm-hmm. the people who are here. And one of the essays in your book here by Michael Omi and Dana Takagi points this out succinctly, saying that, for example, people of Asian, African, and Latino origin represent 47% of the total population. Nearly half of the people in California are of Asian, Black, or Latino origin. 43% of adults, 30% of citizens eligible to vote, 24% of registered, and only 17% of those who actually voted in 1992. 50% of the population, 17% of the actual voters. Isn't this somewhat at the crux of the problem we're seeing here?
Yeah, I mean, there's also the question of age. I mean, the electorate is wealthier, older, and whiter by far than the population. Partly it's a question of citizenship, and partly not. I mean, so you get a kind of an appeal to this electorate is very different than what majority of the people of the state actually would like.
So when you go out and take polls or talk to people on the street and you get one opinion and then you go to the ballot box, and I know this happened with Prop 187 and a lot of people were shocked to see it pass by 2-1, that's partially because who's here isn't who's voting.
Well, if it's a good poll, it's a poll of who's likely to vote.
Yeah. Right. But when you do – I'm not thinking so much of polls but maybe journalistic vox pops where you go out with a microphone in the street and say, what do you think of blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Then blah, blah, blah turns up on the ballot and it turns out very different from what people have been saying.
It's a real issue. When you want to make districts for representational purposes, for example, if you want to get a majority-minority district, which one wants to do under the Voting Rights Act, one has to create a district that's not merely with respect to population but with respect to who can vote and who's likely to vote. It's very complicated and it's very unrepresentative.
Does the court recognize that?
Yes.
Well, we have a lot of we probably can't get into this here, but we have a lot of voting rights cases which are devastating black representation in the South right now, for example, maybe we should get into it here. Are we going to look at the same thing happening here in California?
Well, see, I think those are very interesting cases. The Supreme Court, it used to be under the Voting Rights Act, there was pressure to maximize the representation of minority representatives, say African-American or Hispanic representatives. And recently the court has said, well, no, there are limits to that. And if you, I think myself, and I may be a minority in this, but I think if you look very carefully at those opinions, they are trying to strike the same balance that Powell did in Bakke. That is to say, they still permit you and they encourage you and they require you to have a certain amount of minority representation. But if you go too far such that it's like in your face, then they'll say, no, it'll be struck down. So at the same time as they struck down some districts in the South for being too irregular and being represented minority, they upheld the California redistricting plan, which set out in its preface the notion of maximizing minority representation. But it did it in a way that allowed compact districts, for example, instead of irregular districts. So it's an odd thing that the court's doing.
To get back to affirmative action to conclude here, my favorite small quotation from this issue of your magazine is small in size, not small in implication, is from the article by Troy Duster, who says, who's a professor of sociology at UC Berkeley, who says, to equate affirmative action with race preferences is to purposefully confuse patterns of exclusion by the privileged with efforts to include the previously and currently excluded. In other words, those who are proponents of CCRI in California saying this puts race preferences to the fore really are talking backwards, is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, that's why colorblindness, the slogan they use, is like a way of saying they can't see color. They can see it, and they're precisely using it. They're pretending that it doesn't exist. If you close your eyes, it's not there. So it's an absolute inversion of the reality of a thing.
Well, how do you as academics then feel when you see something so simplistically presented in the political electoral system that is actually so complex and nuanced that you're able to produce an entire academic journal, and you could probably produce 10 academic journals about it? And here it's being presented, Proposition 209 in California, in very simplistic, you're either for or against affirmative action. That's what it's coming down to on Prop 209.
Well, that's why we have interviews like this, and that's why we publish that.
But interviews like this reach only a few thousand, tens of thousands of people in the state of California.
Yeah. Well, you do the best you can. I mean, you feel angry, and then you try to make bring some reason and also some political organization into the arena.
What is your
history, too.
Yeah. What is your impression of the political organization so far around 209? Do you think it has a chance of being defeated?
I'd be pessimistic. But I'm
Why?
Not sure it's because of the political. I think it's very hard for people to acknowledge the point you just made, that there's a history of racialized oppression that requires attention to race, racial categories. If you're going to redress it, it's very hard. It goes against American sense of themselves. So it's a hard issue to crack, I think.
Two things about that. One is that the psychological polling data from the late 70s on have shown consistent opposition to affirmative action generally. On the order of the support we see for CCRI. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the numbers are pretty strong against CCRI, and the only way you move numbers is money. And from what I can see, those who oppose CCRI don't have the money to do it.
Voices of Robert Post, professor of law at UC Berkeley, and Michael Rogan, who's a professor of political science at UC Berkeley. They have edited an issue of the Journal of Cultural Theory called Representations. It's Representations, issue number 55. A dozen or more articles, some of which we've touched on here, dealing with the questions of affirmative action and race and representation. If you're interested in getting a copy, you might try your bookstore, or if you can't find it, call UC Berkeley Press at 510-642-4247. That's 510-642-4247. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I'm Larry Bensky for Democracy Now!
Thank you for that, Larry. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent at our Berkeley Station, KPFA. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And we're staying with KPFA out in Berkeley because Dennis Bernstein is there. Dennis Bernstein, another Pacifica correspondent who for years during the 1980s was co-host of a program called Contragate, and then it became Undercurrents, that was syndicated around the country that covered the whole Iran-Contra scandal, actually going places that the Kerry Committee in Washington and the rest of the media did not dare go. So with the recent revelations in the last month by Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News of cocaine running into this country by the CIA, sending those drugs in one particular case into Los Angeles to the black community through the Bloods and the Crips. This certainly is a deja vu for Dennis, I'm sure. We thought it would be important to expand this story, to re-put it in the context that Dennis, along with Robert Knight at WBI in New York, did so well during the 1980s. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dennis.
Thank you, Amy.
So why don't we take that story that we have brought our listeners on Democracy Now! Of the cocaine trafficking into this country in the 1980s that was done with the help of, or at least the tacit approval of, the Central Intelligence Agency and funneled into poor communities in this country, particularly in Los Angeles, to the black community. Why don't we take that story and now fit it into that context that you investigated for so many years?
Well, Amy, a way to look at this story and to understand the entirety of the network is to take a look at the life and times of Stephen Carr, poor Contra mercenary who died under very strange circumstances of a cocaine overdose, you guessed it, in the streets of Los Angeles. Poor Stephen Carr, in early 1985, Stephen Carr was a drug addict. He was in trouble. He was in jail. He had hocked all of his mother's silver. He had finished several years of watching his brother, who was a heroin addict who became addicted to heroin in Vietnam, shooting rounds of bullets into the Everglades. Steve Carr is pacing in a jail cell near Naples, Florida, and he hears a speech by President Ronald Reagan calling the Contras, the Nicaraguan Contras, the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. Steve Carr decides that he's going to join the Contras and become a freedom fighter and help win the war that his brother couldn't win in Vietnam. So he gets hooked up with the Contras in Miami, and guess what? He finds himself right in the middle of a drug for guns operation. Steve Carr, his experiences from that time on tell the story of the network. Steve Carr ended up participating in a March 6, 1985 weapons shipment that left Fort Lauderdale Airport in broad daylight and went to Ilopango Airport in El Salvador. When Steve Carr met the people in South Miami to load the weapons onto the panel truck that went to the airport, he saw in the same room with all the weapons, including a 20-foot cannon, a whole bunch of cocaine, and he was amazed. He thought that he was giving up cocaine. He was joining a drug network. Steve Carr took those weapons with other mercenaries to the Fort Lauderdale Airport, and they forklifted this equipment in broad daylight at Fort Lauderdale Airport, one of the most heavily surveilled airports in the country. They forklifted the cannon onto a plane. Steve Carr got on that plane, and that plane flew into El Salvador, Ilopango Airport.
Wait a second, Dennis. They forklifted a 20-foot cannon onto a plane, and nobody stopped them?
Nobody stopped them in this heavily surveilled airport in broad daylight. At the time, I interviewed customs people in the area, and I got some response like, well, we'd have to hire everybody in America to surveil all the stuff that goes through. It's a very busy airport. I said, forklifting a 20-foot cannon onto a plane in broad daylight? I would think that would call attention to itself. There was no answer after that.
Now, this was, in 1985, at the time the Boland Amendment was in effect, which said that Congress could not give money to, could not support the Contras who were fighting the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. Is that right?
Exactly. And in Miami and related areas in Florida. And what happened was the CIA moved into Miami, where they had a history of working with anti-Castro Cubans, mercenaries, and they began to expand their network. What they were trying to do is create a southern front in Costa Rica to be an equivalent to the northern front attacking Nicaragua from Honduras. So they began to work there, actually extensively, in 1983 and 1984. We know that the Miami police and the FBI knew about this because we have a September 26, 1984 Miami police intelligence report that this was going on and that the funding for this network was coming from narcotics. This is according to this memo that is then stamped, seen by George Kaczynski of the FBI. Every page of this memo that names some of the early players and says what's going on and says it's supported by narcotics traffickers. The FBI has it. Janet Reno at the time is the state prosecutor. She must have known about this. We can't say for sure, but that's what we know. they started to put together this network, and Steve Carr, who was trying to give up drugs and to become a hero for his country, found himself right in the middle of this drug trafficking operation.
So he flies down with this 20-foot cannon to the Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, which has become so famous as a site for bringing in weapons and sending out drugs.
Well, right. This is the airport that Celerino Castillo III, the DEA agent who was in charge of monitoring drug trafficking and interdiction in El Salvador at the time, verified that in two hangars in that airport there were drugs coming in, weapons going out, so on and so forth. Steve Carr flies into this airport on March 6, 1985, with these weapons. He gets out of the plane. He sees everything. He sees U.S. officials, civilians, military, U.S. military, supervising Salvadoran military, offloading these weapons to smaller planes. Steve Carr then gets on another plane and flies into San Jose, into the commercial airport there, while the weapons go on another plane to the ranch of John Hull. He was an American with dual citizenship who was working with the CIA, Rob Owen, and Oliver North. Mr. Carr gets to the ranch. He's very excited.
This ranch is in San Jose?
This ranch is outside of San Jose, near the border between Nicaragua and Costa Rica. We're talking about San Jose, Costa Rica, the capital, where the main public airport is. Stephen Carr flies into there. He's met by John Hull. He's worried because they have all this military technology, no problem. Hull guides them through with security forces from the Costa Rican government there, and they go to John Hull's ranch, and they're ready to do battle. Steve Carr is very excited, and he's so excited, and he can't wait. So he and a couple of the Contras decide that they're going to do their own little invasion, and they invade Nicaragua from John Hull's ranch in April of 1985. And at that time, Steve Carr gets caught. There's a big to-do. The Costa Rican government arrests him for violations of neutrality laws. He's in jail. Nobody's going to help him. John Hull abandons him in jail. They drop his story. He can't get any help. And Steve Carr begins to sing about the network that he says is setting him up.
We're talking to Dennis Bernstein, a Pacifica correspondent and longtime investigator of the Iran-Contra affair, as it became known in the 1980s. Dennis, we're going to have to break, and then we come back. We'll find out what happens to Stephen Carr after that, as one way to look at this whole guns for drugs operation that took place in Central America and the United States during the 1980s. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Bernstein, Pacifica correspondent out in our Berkeley station, KPFA, who has been following the Iran-Contra affair since it was going on in the early 1980s. Dennis, you left us with Stephen Carr in jail, feeling like he was abandoned by the U.S. government.
That's correct, Amy. And Stephen Carr, at a certain point, got very frustrated. Nobody would help him. John Hull wouldn't help him. U.S. officials wouldn't help him. He was persona non grata. Nobody would talk to him. He felt abandoned. He felt like he was doing the good fight. He was following the president. He was trying to join the Contras, and here he was sitting in a jail cell. So he began to sing, and people began to listen to Steve Carr. And Steve Carr told the story of the weapon shipment that he participated in, about the drug connection, about this operation on John Hull's ranch that was a drug operation. And by the way, he talked about secret landing strips that John Hull controlled, in which planes were landing with drugs and guns, coming in with the guns and going out with the drugs, and they were heading into the United States. He began to talk about this. He began to be interviewed by U.S. officials, by investigators for John Kerry.
And, Just one second, Dennis, again, because the story has so many details, let's step back for a minute. John Hull, explain exactly who he is.
John Hull is a U.S. citizen. He actually has dual citizenship for the United States and Costa Rica. He has a long relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. He has a ranch near the border of Nicaragua. That ranch was used as a jumping off point, as a training operation for this illegal Southern Front that was being set up by the CIA. At a certain point, this was an operation that was led by former Nicaraguan hero, Eden Pastora. Pastora was dropped by the CIA because he wouldn't follow orders. And Then from there, John Hull really took control. Everything was happening around his ranch. Contras were being trained, drugs going out, weapons coming in, and Carr saw all of this.
So take us forward with Carr. What happens to him after this?
Well, Carr ends up in this jail cell. He's about to testify at a trial. John Hull is trying to sue two American reporters, Martha Honey and Tony Avergan, for libeling him. Carr is going to testify against John Hull. Right before the trial, Stephen Carr is hustled out of the country by U.S. officials. He ends up back in the United States. He's terrified. He is arrested first for probation violations, but then he's freed. He gets on a plane. He takes this plane to Los Angeles to stay with his sister. He's terrified. He tells friends that he's been death threatened, that he's going to be killed. And not too long after that, in December of 1986, Stephen Carr is found dead in a street in Los Angeles of a drug overdose. There are many questions about how he died, about the way the autopsy was carried out. I can tell you this, he died right before he was going to give testimony to Congress. I was told by congressional investigators that Stephen Carr's testimony was believable and crucial in terms of making the case against the Contras and against the CIA for being involved in this drug trafficking operation.
And what did the investigators for the Kerry subcommittee think happened to Stephen Carr?
Well, they didn't speculate on what could have happened to him, but I can tell you, Amy, I spent months trying to figure out, looking at the various autopsy reports, the way in which his body lied for several days in state and people had access to it that shouldn't have had access to the body. It was a very troubling situation. When we finally got a look at the autopsy, supposedly he had shot himself up sort of from the back of his elbow. It didn't make sense, Amy. Many people were suspicious about this. We can't say for sure what happened, but it is certainly ironic that on the one hand, Stephen Carr's brother becomes a heroin addict from Southeast Asia, where the CIA was involved there with heroin smugglers. Then he ends up in Los Angeles with a drug overdose, a cocaine overdose, right in the arena of where the Contra operation is flooding the area with cocaine.
Dennis, as you finished telling that story, the story of Stephen Carr, whose life ended in 1986, what are your thoughts on the San Jose Mercury News revelations about the CIA helping or at least tacitly approving of those supporting the Contras, bringing drugs into this country to use the profits to get weapons and other things for the Contras?
I think, Amy, that it's really important to understand that this isn't simply an operation of Central Intelligence. When you look at what was going in Miami, what Stephen Carr witnessed when he was in El Salvador, he learned that a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez, who was meeting with the National Security Advisor Donald Gregg to George Bush, you can see that this was an operation that was CIA-driven, but it was including many aspects of the United States government. The North Network depended on the NSA, the DIA, the State Department. So I'm thinking that as we look at the San Jose Mercury News, which really locks down the California connection and shows how the Contras really created the crack cocaine problem in Los Angeles. In order to really talk about this story and understand it, you have to understand that the FBI was involved in terms of covering up the information. As I said earlier, there's the September 26 memo from the Miami Police Intelligence that was stamped seen by George Kaczynski. You've got the FBI involved in the cover-up instead of the investigation. You've got many aspects of the U.S. government involved in this. And I think a proper investigation would include looking into many of the players in many of the U.S. agencies that participated in this. And Stephen Carr was one of those few people, poor Stephen Carr, 26 years old, trying to become a hero, who saw everything and I believe suffered for what he saw.
Let's talk about John Kerry for a minute, the man, or at least the man whose committee Stephen Carr was going to testify before. John Kerry is now involved with a race for the Senate. He is the senator from Massachusetts, but William Weld is challenging him. He is the Republican governor of Massachusetts. I've been watching their debates. They've had a series of them. They'll have a few more. And of course, drugs and crimes, like in debates all over the country, like with the presidential race, seem to be the major issue. Yet when Weld attacks Kerry around the issue of drugs and the Democratic approach to drugs, Kerry does not respond with any of the knowledge he accumulated during the 1980s about who was bringing drugs into this country under President Reagan and Vice President Bush. Can you talk about Kerry and the subcommittee that he ran and what they ultimately came up with?
Well, that subcommittee, and I've had extensive discussions with a key investigator who worked with Kerry about that investigation and around that investigation. It was an extraordinary investigation. Senator Kerry really did attempt to look at what was going on, look at how the Contras were involved with drug trafficking. They had interviews with law enforcement officials who knew something about this, with many Contra operatives, with people from the Medellin cartel who were in jail. They took extensive testimony. By the way, that testimony should be released. Kerry learned, and he said that America's intelligence community was transformed into the use of covert channels for drug traffickers. Kerry learned a lot, but unfortunately on that committee also was a man by the name of Alphonse D'Amato. He was the senior ranking minority official on the committee. The minority side would not sign on to this report.
From New York, of course.
The senator from New York, Alphonse D'Amato, who's now chairing the Dole Finance Committee. Alphonse and the Whitewater investigation, Mr. Come Clean Alphonse D'Amato. D'Amato apparently suppressed this investigation. You might, by the way, take note that D'Amato, a little bit ago, about a month ago, called for an investigation into the MENA Arkansas airport, where there was some cocaine transshipped by this network. But that investigation didn't go anywhere. The next day, D'Amato didn't mention it again, and he didn't, because he realized that this is a bipartisan operation, that the cover-up comes from both sides. Kerry, I believe, and this is my belief, that he got the word at a certain point, national security, you can't go any further with this. And understand, we talked about John Hull before. John Hull was indicted by the Costa Rican government after an extensive investigation in which Hull, North, and some of his other people were considered persona non grata for creating the drug trafficking problem in Costa Rica. When John Hull was indicted for trafficking, drug trafficking and murder, he was hustled out of the country by the DEA back into the United States. When the Costa Rican government asked for extradition of John Hull to stand trial, Lee Hamilton, who was the chair of the Iran-Contra Committee, the Democratic side, wrote a letter that was signed on by at least a dozen other congressmen that essentially told the Costa Rican government, first of all, they asked Oscar Arias to step in personally and undermine the investigation. He said, hey, we have a justice system here. Well, I'm not going to undermine the investigation. Wrote him back an angry letter. What Hamilton wrote to the Costa Rican government then was, if you do go after John Hull, believe me, we will make you suffer in terms of loan guarantees. We will make your life miserable as a government. So, by the way, that extradition is still open, but nothing has ever happened about that. Final thing. What happened when the Iran-Contra Committee investigated? They hired a man by the name of Tom Polgar. Tom Polgar was the senior investigator to find out whether, in fact, there was a Contra-CIA drug connection. Tom Polgar was formerly the CIA station chief in Vietnam. He was the man who told the world that the United States was winning the war when the embassy was on fire. This man was called a perpetual liar by then-Congresswoman Bella Abzug. Abzug used to refer to Polgar, when he got done with the document, as polgarizing the documents. Polgar found no, there was no drug CIA connection, nothing going on there. Tom Polgar was hired by the Iran-Contra committees, the big committees. He worked for Lee Hamilton, and for the Iran-Contra committees, he was the senior Democratic investigator for the Iran-Contra committees.
And distinguish the Iran-Contra committee from John Kerry's subcommittee in time and also in subject area and what they were investigating.
Well, these two investigations overlapped. Senator Kerry became very interested very early about what was going on. At that same time, the Iran-Contra committees were formed. Kerry kept up his investigation, and after Iran-Contra finished, he kept going. And his Committee on Narcotics and International Terrorism was really the lightning rod, the key committee that really investigated this. But Tom Polgar was the man hired by the bigger committees, the senior investigator for the double Iran-Contra, the House and Senate committees, to look into various aspects of the affair, including was there a drug connection. Tom Polgar, as I said, was the former CIA station chief in Vietnam. He had a reputation for deceiving the American public. This man stepped forward, investigated the CIA-Contra drug connection, and guess what? He didn't find out a thing.
And let's go back to Weld for a second, since we're looking at this senatorial race between Kerry and William Weld. What was William Weld doing at the time?
Well, this is very interesting. There was a major Justice Department cover-up. People in Miami, a man by the name of John Mattis, who was working as an investigator with Kerry, was attempting to bring information out about this. And he was threatened every time he popped up with some serious information, tried to provide it to prosecutors, to the FBI. He was threatened by the FBI with prosecution if he went further. They tried to provide this information to the Justice Department under Ed Meese. You remember Ed Meese? He had the press conference in November that said there was a diversion of funds. He didn't know anything about it. But it seems that the people under him, including William Weld, were working full time to suppress this investigation so that it never saw the light of day. And let me tell you, everybody who attempted to go forward on this were threatened, like Senator John Kerry. They talked about national security violations. He didn't make any friends in the Senate trying to go forward with this. John Mattis, as I said, was threatened with prosecution. Jack Terrell, a Contra mercenary who tried to blow the whistle when he went to Honduras and found out that Enrique Bermudez was a drug-dealing rapist. He tried to talk about this. This guy found himself arrested by the FBI and accused of threatening to kill the president.
And explain again who Enrique Bermudez was.
Enrique Bermudez was the man chosen by the CIA to lead the Contras in Honduras. He was the former National Guard Somoza employee who was then enlisted by the Central Intelligence Agency to invade Nicaragua from Honduras.
So what is your sense of where things will go now? I mean, you have a natural constituency to look into the whole issue of drugs being brought into this country with the support of the CIA into a black community. You've got the Congressional Black Caucus. I just covered a Democratic Congress members meeting where a number of Congress members went to speak to Gary Webb to be briefed on his story in the San Jose Mercury News. But do you think that Democrats will push this? Because, in fact, it could cut both ways.
Indeed, as I said, you've got Lee Hamilton, you've got the Senate that fell short, that earlier investigation that fell short. This is a problem. I was very concerned to hear from Janet Reno. First of all, she immediately, as in a knee-jerk way, said that there was no information that she knew of to support this. I kept thinking about that September 26 memorandum from the Miami Police Intelligence, the narcotics unit, that said that the Contra network was operative in Miami, that there were illegal training camps, that it was funded by narcotics money. This memo was stamped, seen by the FBI, George Kaczynski. I wonder where that man is right now. So I'm concerned that Janet Reno now says that the Justice Department is cooperating fully with the Inspector General of the Central Intelligence Agency. This is quite worrisome. As I said in the past, this was covered up one time. Amy, I wrote a series of cover stories that was in the San Francisco Examiner. The Spin Magazine article was covered widely. I was on major networks talking about this all the time. So I'm troubled that no matter what we do, the Central Intelligence Agency will have the power and will be able to intimidate the major media into not covering the story. So I'm looking at this as a situation where it's not just the Central Intelligence Agency, as I said before, but many institutions of the United States government were working with Oliver North. And because it's such a wide-ranging operation, so many people engaged and involved, I am troubled and worried that this investigation will not go anywhere. And I am also worried that Maxine Waters will get the President Aristide treatment. You remember President Aristide began to speak up, stand up for his people. All of a sudden, he was crazy. He was in a hospital in Canada. He was taking drugs. He liked to kill people by burning them to death. I am worried that we're going to start to see a whole bunch of disinformation that will undermine this story.
And, of course, Oliver North continues to broadcast over radio airwaves from here in the Washington, D.C. area.
Well, you know, Amy, and that is really troublesome. One needs to go back to Oliver North's notebooks and see the scores of entries that have to do with drugs. For instance, the one that I find very, very troubling is when Oliver North is writing in his notebook on July 9th, 1984. Went and talked to Contra leader Federico Vaughn, who wanted aircraft to go to Bolivia to pick up paste, wanted aircraft to pick up 1,500 kilos. Kilos of what? Sugar?
What do you think should happen to Oliver North?
I think that there should be a grand jury convened.
There was one convened.
I think that there should be another one convened, and they should call Celerino Castillo III, who was the DEA agent in charge in El Salvador, who tried to talk to the U.S. ambassador contemporaneously with the information that he was finding, who tried to confront George Bush, who brought his information to the special prosecutor, FBI agents for the special prosecutor. Now, I verified that, in fact, Celerino Castillo III did talk to FBI agents for the Iran prosecutor's investigation. They didn't do a thing with the material, and one has to wonder why. I say a grand jury, investigate the notebooks, major discovery, release the Kerry Commission material, and let's get started again on a real investigation of who was involved and who knows what about what. Celerino Castillo III has a memorandum. He names a whole bunch of drug traffickers and pilots hired by Oliver North. They have DEA file numbers. Let's get the files out and find out what's going on.
Things could get dangerous, Dennis, especially with this week, Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and House Speaker Newt Gingrich introducing a bill that would sentence a first-time drug carrier into this country to life without parole. And if he's caught a second time, if he or she is caught a second time, given the death penalty, what could this mean for people like those you've been talking about?
Well, like Oliver North, maybe he would get off with just life in prison.
Dennis Bernstein, we're going to have to leave it at that. Dennis Bernstein, Pacifica correspondent from KPFA in Berkeley. And we'll continue following the Iran-Contra trail. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer has been Errol Maitland. Our director, Brother Shine. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!